Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, Stack Waddy Game. Shall I go first?
Proceed.
Okay, my category is the category...
Poised, about to write these down.
All right, fine. It's something I personally loathe, actually. It's that category called alt-country.
Oh, right, okay.
Usually denotes people who've taken design degrees, pretending that they are poor Appalachian, you know, hillbillies and, or oaky refugees fleeing the Dust Bowl, heading for California. Anyway.
But the sad thing about it is that it indicates also that country is something to be embarrassed about.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, let's be honest, country is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why do you have to be old country to be acceptable?
Yeah.
It's wrong. It's very wrong.
It is wrong.
Carry on.
Anyway. They tend to have names that are somehow redolent of poverty. Yes?
The sort of
thing that they like. Okay. So we've got five names of alt country acts here. Okay? And one of them is made up. Okay, here are the five. Trailer Park.
Yeah.
Two Cow Garage.
Very good.
Yep. Golden Smog.
Yep.
The Deep Dark Woods and Backyard Tire Fire. Okay. Trailer Park, Two Cow Garage, Golden Smog, The Deep Dark Woods.
Oh my goodness.
Backyard
Tire. I think I know actually. Because
right.
I just get the feeling that I know which one you made up because it's just so funny. And it rather debunks the concept, which they probably wouldn't want to do. Trailer Park, I would imagine, is true. Again, austerity, the tough life. Two Cow Garage is very, very funny. I go for that. Golden Smog, possibly okay. Deep Dark Woods, I would say definitely. It's got that kind of gothic quality to it. But the one I think, Dave Hepworth, that you've made up, I put it to you, then it's Backyard Tire Fire, because that is just hilariously lampooning of the whole thing.
Well, you're wrong. Backyard Tire Fire are genuine, as are The Deep Dark Woods, as are Golden Smog, as is Two Cow Garage. The one I made up was Trailer Park.
Very good.
Okay.
Absolutely brilliant.
Over to you.
I was going to plunge you into the dark satanic mills of Scandinavian black metal.
Oh joy!
So joy. I mean, try it. I mean, here they are, the six of them. One of them's not real. Okay, there's Hellhammer. These are all Swedish or Norwegian.
Hellhammer.
Okay. Right. Okay. Right. There's Gorgoroth.
Like it's a city where the Winter Olympics take place. Hellhammer. Go on. Sorry. Second one.
Gorgoroth.
Gorgoroth. Yeah.
Dissection.
Yeah. All
right. Dark Throne.
Yeah.
There's Burzum. And there is Burzum. It's good, isn't it? It's chilling.
Burzum, it's in the potteries, isn't it?
There's Nazgul.
So you've got six, have you?
I've got six. Okay. One of them's a ring.
Okay.
Hellhammer, Gorgoroth, Dissection, Dark Throne, Burzum, and Nazgul.
Yeah. Well, I haven't got a clue. So I'm gonna plump for Hellhammer.
Okay, no, real. I'm afraid. Now I even thought that you might have spotted the ringer, which is obviously Nazgul, because they are the dreaded ring servants of the Dark Lord Sauron of Middle Earth throughout the Second and Third Ages. As any fool know, and thus crowbarred in there by me.
They're
great names, aren't they?
That's very good.
Very good.
Well, talking of potential frauds perpetrated on the public, have you followed this story of the lads? Well, Phil Collins in the air tonight has gone back in the
job. Oh, yeah, the Williams brothers. Is it Williams brothers?
Okay.
Yeah.
The Williams brothers, Williams twins. his brothers, who posted this video clip on YouTube of the two of them listening to In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins for allegedly the first time, and being kind of their jaws dropping when the drums come in at that very particular
interval. Which is rather fantastic, actually, that moment, isn't it? It has to be said, it is brilliant, and it was an incredible drum sound and has been sampled a million times. But I know what you're going to say, because I'm going to agree with you. Can that be true, that they have managed to negotiate a path through life without ever once hearing that record? And they might not have been aware that that's what they were listening to, but how could you avoid actually hearing
it? I would have thought it's fairly unlikely. You know, because even if you weren't aware that it had been a big hit, it gets sampled all over the place. It turns up in movies. It'll probably be in commercials. You know, all kind of music travels around in all kinds of different ways nowadays, doesn't it? And it also doesn't just... The interesting thing about popular music nowadays, as opposed to 30, 40 years ago, is it doesn't just have its moment of hotness and then disappears. It has a moment of hotness, but then it continues, doesn't it? You know what I mean? Music sticks around far longer nowadays than it ever used to do in the past.
Completely. It's inescapable.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and also, this is not clearly, this is, just think about the logistics of this. These guys are kind of, they've had a series of very successful YouTube clips of them allegedly listening to music, pieces, well-known pieces of music for the first time. So, what are we supposed to believe? Are we supposed to believe that right now, you know, well, they're in bed at the moment because they're in the States, but, you know, in a few hours' time, the Williams brothers get up and they just sit, they establish themselves in a couple of chairs in front of a camera, and then somebody plays them a series of legendary hits that they may not have heard. You know what I mean? Most of which are kind of, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen's Dancing in the Dark or Hotel California or whatever. Most of them are interrupted after about 5 seconds by one or the other of them going, oh, I've heard this. You know what I mean? Don't worry, next. I've heard this, next. And then you suddenly get to one that they haven't heard and they go, oh, hang on. And then they record themselves. I mean, it's a preposterous idea. You know what I mean? Because it's something that so much needs rehearsal, doesn't it? To make things like that work. It needs the two of them to sit there and agree which bit they're going to respond to.
Yeah.
It doesn't work if one of them goes off after 15 seconds and somebody else is planning to go in after 25 seconds. It doesn't work at all, practically speaking. It's a piece of theatre. That's what it is. It's been practiced as a piece of theatre, and it's a very effective piece of theatre, but it's not real. It can't be, can it?
It can't be real. And another thing is, surely there must be technical problems too. You know, any kind of recording has technical problems and you have to redo things. So, you know, yes. There's a breakdown of the link or there's some kind of screw up with the camera or whatever. So, again, if you've started doing something where you claim you don't know what's about to happen, you know, I think it'd be very hard to then, if you started from the top again, to give the impression that it was completely virgin territory. Yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah, and also they can't. I mean, they had great success with doing. They did them listening to Dolly Parton's Jolene.
How can they possibly have avoided hearing that?
Well, I find that slightly easier to believe than Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight. Jolene's a very old record, you know. 1971, I think it is. And, you know, it's perfectly possible, you know, if you're born in, I don't know, the early part of this century, not to have heard that. But In the Air Tonight, it's a very, very different kind of thing, I think. And also, once you've done it, you can't do another one. You can't say, oh, hello, here we are back again. 2 weeks later, we found another classic that we've never heard before. You know what I mean? It's like virginity. You only lose it once, can't you, really?
You're testing their honesty of saying that they haven't heard it before, because presumably this must be, the ideas must come from their producer, mustn't it?
Well, I don't know. It could be their idea. Yeah, maybe. Yes, I suppose it's got to be.
So it's got the producer saying, you've never heard this. Yeah, so let me try out a series of things on you. But as you say, I mean, do they really then say halfway through, actually, I do know this and there's no point in that. It's not authentic anymore. It's just wrong.
It's but I'm sure Phil Collins is not complaining. You know, if it brings his.
I know. I thought that was lovely. That was so many hits. He got it back in the charts. Although getting back in the charts doesn't require a huge number of hits.
You and I get back in the charts.
It does. It does get a certain amount of press, and it gets people talking about it, like, as we are now.
So as we are now.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So I was looking at this thing the other day about the Field of Streams, where Green Man is going to stream live various people who'd be playing at the festival, and which kind of led me to look at the thing about Sam Fender. I think you saw this guy Sam Fender, local hero up in Newcastle, who played the Gosforth Park, and it was the first kind of consider it probably genuinely successful socially distanced live event, in that they had 500 metal platforms, each spaced 2 meters apart. They were like individual pods, and you could have five people in each one. And there's a table and chairs, and each one had its own fridge, and you could pre-order all your drinks beforehand. So it's kind of like a private box. I mean, it doesn't look wildly appetizing in the pictures, but it clearly worked, you know, and that 2,500 people could sit there and watch a live event. And, you know, as we were discussing the other day, maybe what's happening here is there's just a massive shift in the balance of power. Because previously you had a situation where musicians were, you know, people were desperate to go and see them. And now they're in a position where they are desperate to get people to come and see. Yes. And so in the past, you could argue that what they were doing, a lot of it, although it was passed off as part of the entertainment, and it was, you know, the cantilevered walkways, the cherry picker cranes, you know, the fast pyrotechnics, etc., the expensive home movies shown on the backdrops, all that's part of the package. But you could argue, and I don't think it's unkind to do so, that might have been a way of trying to justify playing such enormous venues. You know, you're playing, I mean, unless you're one of those groups that are about sound and spectacle, the Pink Floyd and the Grateful Dead being really good examples, where actually, you know, a seat at the back, as it were, of a big outside event was very, very attractive. I remember seeing the Orb at Glastonbury and thinking, this is great being a long way away from this. I don't need to be near the front. But otherwise, you could argue that you know, that musicians are simply, you know, trying to come up with elaborate ways to justify playing somewhere absolutely enormous and charging a vast amount of money.
I don't think there's any doubt that's what they've been doing. That's what they're doing. And that's what they've been doing for a long time. And you know, you say, you make a distinction between the acts who offer a spectacle and the rest. I would suggest, you know, over the last 10 years, increasingly everybody has offered a spectacle, because that's become a way of justifying the price you charge. You know, so that people don't go away from big gigs saying, do you know, I really like the version of so-and-so that they did, and I thought they got a really good vocal sound. I felt very warm the way she sang so-and-so. They don't. That's not how they do it at all. They go, well, did you see the fireworks? Did you see the, you know, the plane overhead? All that kind of bread and circuses aspect of the entertainment becomes immensely important when people aren't close enough to have got any of the more kind of intimate pleasures, if you put it that way. And so,
and they're looking to respond to that too, because that's different from the experience of listening to the music at home. That's partly what you get by physically going to see somebody, you know, live, you know.
But I think, you see, I think this is quite significant. Well, it's obviously significant. What's happened at the moment is, I think it's brought to a close what I call the age of spectacle. And I suppose the age of spectacle will have begun in the 80s. And I suppose one of the great jumping off points, and we've discussed it many times on the podcast, was Live Aid. Because one of the things that Live Aid did was it made loads of people sitting at home in front of their tellies thinking, suddenly looking at it, going, wow, live rock and roll, that looks
attractive.
That looks attractive. The blue sky, there's loads going on. It's, you know, there's no boring bits, all that kind of stuff. I can sway my arms from one side to the other. That sounds like the kind of entertainment me and my family would really enjoy. And they duly did. And they paid increasing amounts, sums of money. as the acts at the same time increased the production values to justify the increasing sums of money. And so you got on this kind of mad ratchet effect in that, you know, you had
it got more expensive and then it got more elaborate.
£100 to pay for the extraordinary staging that you have never seen before, you know, where they, and what they're really trying to do is to make acceptable an entertainment experience which at its root is really unsatisfactory. And everybody knew that back in the late 70s and the early 80s, before this became kind of standard. You know, we talked about this before. Bruce Springsteen had never played outdoors until he played Slane Castle in Ireland.
That's right, 1985.
In 1985, he'd never done it. And nowadays, you can't imagine him doing anything but, really, you know, or any kind of acts of that magnitude. And so there was clearly a period where people thought, I will never get used to big outdoor gigs. And then there was a period where people said, I can't imagine not having big outdoor gigs. Well, we've probably come to the end of that latter period now. And so what you've got with Sam Fender is quite interesting, is that you've got an outdoor gig, which is not big, really. I mean, it's a reasonable, I mean, we've only seen the photographs. It's a reasonable scale. But you're not going to be many miles away from it, are you?
No, and then, the number of people who went was about half the number of people who go to the Hammersmith Odeons we used to call
it.
Okay.
So, you know. And I thought, I looked at it and thought, I thought, well, that looks a bit cold. You know, that looks looks like a kind of agricultural show with all the kind of railings. In, you know, I go past all these pens where cattle are in.
Yeah, the steam engines will be on in a moment. Yeah.
But then again, I thought, well, if I was there, I'd probably quite enjoy it. Once I got on my platform, on my seat, where I could see and all those,
and here,
all those kind of rare luxuries.
Raining. Yeah.
Yeah, if it wasn't raining, as ever. But that's always going to be the case. But it's interesting. The other day, I had a great great adventure, Mark. You're going to be very envious.
Go on.
I went to a pub. Didn't go in it. And sat outside the pub and had 2 pints of Guinness with our old friends and colleagues, Kate Mossman and Fraser Lurie. And, God, it was delightful. Right, just sitting outside the pub, just having 2 pints, and then 90 minutes or whatever. And you know, one of the things that made it really delightful was that at regular intervals, the waitress would come out from the pub and say, "Can I get you more drinks?" And then she'd duly go away and get them, put them there. And you thought to yourself, you know, now normally, you know, if you're a summer evening outside a London pub, your heart sinks when you get to the end of a drink and you have to go in and get around. Am I right? You know what
Absolutely.
I mean? You've got to do battle somehow with a bloody millions of people in there. And then you've got to carry back the order through the crowd and all that. And you thought, suddenly, this is now being changed. And it's like you're saying about gigs. For my convenience as the customer, they're having to do what makes me comfortable, rather than me having to do what makes them make money. Now, I know it's really difficult.
So we are momentarily in a good position, aren't we? In that they are absolutely desperate to seduce us into going back and participating.
And frankly, I wouldn't mind. I'll pay for that. I'll pay for that convenience, you know. And probably the same thing would apply with gigs. And that, you know, they charge on the Sam Fender thing, they charge something, a £20 charge per party to reserve the platform, per party.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind that at all. You know, if you're going to go with your party and you're going to be guaranteed that they're going to be able to see.
And no one's going to be spilling lager over your shoes.
Absolutely.
And even if they're shouting and singing along, you can't really hear them. And so, exactly.
So I thought it looked rather, you know, obviously it looked clinical. It didn't look like a rock and roll gig. And, you know, because a lot of the appeal of rock and roll gigs is you're taking part in the photo opportunity, aren't you?
Completely.
You're making it look good. You're making it look good for the acts and the promoter and so forth at the price of your own comfort.
There have been moments in the past, I'm sure with you, where you thought this has got to change. I can remember going to see Bob Dylan at the O2 in 2009. And I think there was a tube strike at the time because we had to get down there by boat. And we met some people on the boat who'd never seen Dylan before. They'd come down to London, first time ever, incredibly excited. And you're thinking, God, don't, you've left it a long time. And now you're seeing him in the O2. And clearly just tacked on an extra date because he's over here doing a series of smaller venues, you know. And he hadn't got any screens. So he played the O2 with no big screens and a fairly modest sound system. So you could barely hear what was going on and you certainly couldn't see a thing. And I just felt for these people thinking, how absolutely miserable is this experience? They've come down to London, they're having to stay in hotels for two nights. You know? And you think, we shouldn't put up with this. And now we're in a position where we're not having to put up with this because, you know, as I say, the shift of power has changed, isn't it?
And also, the shocking thing is that in the midst of this, where obviously loads of big tours have been cancelled, postponed, rolled over to next year, maybe the year after, who knows? In some cases, they've hung on to people's money, which I think is pretty damn staggering.
Yes.
When you consider how much money these gigs cost. So effectively, you have lent, you know, £100 to Band X.
They're behaving like airlines.
Interest
There's no lower form of...
Well, really, you know, airlines don't charge as much as bands do, you know. And now I think going back to what you say, I think there ought to be some tilt in the kind of power relationship between the audience and the performer here, which I think will be no bad thing. Because I think we've had a long time where the power has been clearly in the other direction. And I'll tell you the other thing that happened, and it's interesting, we go back to the Springsteen example, and Bob Dylan's a good example as well, and probably Paul McCartney and all these people. They have never been in the audience at these gigs. They don't know what it's like.
That's a really good point.
They've never grown up, you know, going to gigs of that kind. When they grew up and they went to gigs, they went to the Finsbury Park Astoria or to the, you know,
occasions they would go and see a mate of theirs play a big venue, presumably they'd be side of the stage or there'd be some kind of little box nearby.
They certainly haven't had the experience that you have had in going to a big gig, which starts at kind of 10 o'clock in the morning, which is
creeping anxiety.
Creeping anxiety.
Nerves looks at the weather forecast.
And climaxes at sort of 10:30 in the evening, where you're in a space where the band are supposedly transporting you to another dimension, while really you're in there thinking, where did I park the car?
That's right.
God, what time did the tubes close?
Yeah.
You know. What time does the babysitter leave? All those kind of things. You know, there's never been a greater kind of contrast between the mindset of the people on stage and the mindset of the people in the audience. And surely, you know, live performance in rock and roll has changed regularly over 50, 60 years. Is it impossible that it might change again as a consequence of this? And that somebody might come up with a format which people are not going to look at and go, well, that's a reduced version of what I had before, but I don't mind doing it.
Or they might think,
this is better. This is an improved version. You know, so that's my challenge.
Which they're going to have to, aren't they? And it's going to, and also the circuit itself, it may be that it's not going to be much bigger than 3,000. I mean, it's possible, isn't it? Maybe for the foreseeable future, that's the absolute limit of how many people can be gathered together in one space to see anybody.
And therefore, it will be the people who really want to go, I suppose.
Yeah.
Although that will probably depend on how they disseminate the tickets. Because, you know, like we've said before, back in 1974 or whatever, the people who wanted to see Led Zeppelin were the people who went and queued outside Earl's Court all night to go and see Led Zeppelin. Because that's the only way you could do it. In the days of, you know, checks and stamped address envelopes and postal orders and things sent to promoters and box offices and so forth. Nowadays, it's credit cards and mobile phones. And so, you know, people buy these things with as little thought as they, you know, as they make a transaction at a bank or something. Whereas it used to take a massive commitment in terms of time just to get the tickets in the first place. Who knows? That may return. Watch this space.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Viewers and listeners, I cannot recommend more highly the upcoming book by preeminent music writer David Hepworth.
Oh, here it is.
There it is. What a extraordinary twist of synchronicity. We happen to have a copy of there. Overpaid, oversexed, and over there. And it's fantastic. I'm reading at the moment. It's absolutely fantastic. And there's a bit that struck me as a really interesting point, which I'd never really dawned on me before, is about the Stones' 1965 American tour. And up to, which is, let's be honest, 55 years ago. And up till then, pretty much the majority of groups had played in uniform, hadn't they? They dressed the same. Yeah. You know, the Beatles, weirdly, the Beatles actually dressed in uniform their entire lives up until... Yeah. Didn't they? Up until the Apple Roof performance.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Even magical mystery tour, they're actually in a uniform.
They're actually wearing a kind of they're not identical, but it's in the same.
That's so true. That's a really interesting tangent. And that applied to most psychedelic groups. It was kind of motley, but it was uniform motley, wasn't it? It's agreed what you're going to look like. Anyway.
Yeah, he's wearing orange trousers. He's wearing lime green ones, but they're still psychedelic somehow. Yeah, they come as a package. There's nobody really stands out. But anyway, you made the point that the Stones dress as individuals. You know, they dress completely differently. And they also wore the same clothes that they were wearing all day. And so they just went on stage and dress up to go on stage, which is a deliberate part of the whole package. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And from then on, groups tended to have an individual look.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, they go on stage at the Academy of Music in New York in spring 1965. And that's the thing that really strikes the audience where they walked on. Oh, look, they looked as if they just walked in off the street. I mean, the likelihood is that they had got changed or something, but they didn't wear a uniform because the all musical acts pretty much up to then had worn uniforms. You know, jazz groups wore uniforms. You know, classical musicians obviously wore uniforms. They wore, you know, evening dress, dinner jackets, whatever. You know, country and western groups dressed up as kind of cowhands, or whatever. That's what you did. You know, putting on the uniform said something about the music you were going to play. It was clearly a performance. And the same thing, you know, so all entertainers who appeared on television had uniforms. You know, acrobats had uniforms. Magicians had uniforms.
Yeah, completely.
Everybody had uniforms. And I can remember a huge part of the appeal of the Rolling Stones in the early days was, and I think it's something that gets forgotten, is that they were masters of television. They absolutely commanded the TV camera. They just looked straight back at the TV camera in a kind of surly, challenging way.
And Jagger was particularly good at spotting Jagger one with the red light. Brilliant.
Absolutely.
Even better than Paul McCartney. He just kind of just keyed in to you.
Absolutely.
Held your attention.
And he always, with every new song, every new hit, he always had a little gesture that he would develop to plug it. And, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's all television. It's not a stage thing.
Yeah.
And Satisfaction, I don't even remember this, when Charlie's famous drum break came in Satisfaction, he always went as if to slap the camera. It was like, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Which every like 14
hands.
All that stuff. Exactly. Yeah. And it was meat and drink to 14, 15-year-old boys particularly, who would then go and imitate it in the playground. You know, it was a bit of Mick Jagger you could kind of take home, you could do. But going back to the uniform, is that the beauty was that every time they appeared in a new picture or a new TV appearance, you'd look at what they were wearing. And it was just subtly varied, everything they were wearing.
Yeah.
They clearly had a sense of chic. And there was no stylist to work at all, you know, but there were really interesting elements that they put together.
And they must have cleared it with each other beforehand.
Possibly.
They must have, because nobody ever clashed, you know. There'd be the little suede jacket and the elephant cords and the big buckle belts.
Absolutely. Their trousers and their hips always look really narrow. That was kind of part, that was their silhouette, you know. And this is in the days, obviously, before the flare. And so bands, in terms of appearance, they went out the shoulders and then they went down.
Tapered.
And narrowed.
That's right.
They tapered
to the
little chisel-toed shoes. Or, you know, or Brian Jones would have white shoes. Or they would have, Mick Jagger would have, like, corduroy sneakers he'd wear, you know.
All yes, he did, yeah.
All these tiny bits of detail, you know, big belt buckles over, yeah. You know, short hipster trousers. And so it was just, there was a wealth of detail to focus on, but I don't think they intended to do it. I mean, if you look at the Rolling Stones very early on, they are wearing uniforms, you know, they had those houndstooth check suits that they wore very
Polish
early
jackets.
On, but
yeah.
they abandoned that. And it was a big thing about them in America. And so I think, and the Byrds, who had been, it's quite interesting how all this happened, you know, the Byrds looked at the Beatles in Hard Day's Night and said, that's what we want to look like. And so, I don't know, in the early days of the Byrds, were they wearing suits? They might have done.
They were wearing suits. Yeah, and even when they kind of
stopped, didn't they?
Yeah, and even when it changed, they still looked, you know, when David Crosby got the cape and everything, they still looked kind of as part of the same kind of uniform visual setup.
I suppose so. But if you consider, you know, you could argue that the Rolling Stones' greatest contribution to rock and roll is they influenced how people dressed. So 90% of bands ever since have followed in the footsteps of the Rolling Stones in that kind of trying to look as if they haven't been dressed by a professional, by a stylist.
Yeah.
And their dress is supposedly an expression of their individuality, but it kind of fits together with the other four or five or whatever in the group. And so they invented that way of dressing. So, you know. Anyway.
So other big inventions, other big pivotal changes? I'm saying Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong invented the solo.
Did he really?
Yeah, because I don't think before Louis Armstrong people played solos. I think what they did is they played sections of 24 bars or whatever. So you play the riff, and then you play a different arrangement of the riff, playing from sheet music, and you play just a little, just varieties of the same thing, the vocal sections or whatever, and then you wind up. But basically, the group knew exactly what they'd be playing all the way through the song. And Louis Armstrong invented the idea that he initially, and eventually other members of the group, would go off and take that 24 bars, and improvise. And so, which is a very clever way also of extending the set. So you can make a song that was normally on sheet music quite short. You could extend it kind of indefinitely if you wanted to. And I'm fairly sure that that's where that started. And
the idea of the solo was a
jazz thing. And then obviously if it started in jazz, it was then copied immediately in about 1966 or whatever by the lead, the arrival of the lead guitarist.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a pivotal moment.
But it's also, you can only feature, I mean, Louis Armstrong's records, or Louis, as we should say. He plays with King Oliver, doesn't he? And then he goes out on his own, and his records are credited as Louis Armstrong, his Hot Five or Hot Seven or whatever. So he is credited as the leader. Therefore, he has to play a solo.
Yeah, it's expected, exactly.
Because if all you hear is just him chiming in with everybody else,
yeah,
it's your change.
Then you're not getting your money's worth.
Yeah. It's funny.
Another one, surely the Kinks. I would say, you really got me.
Go on.
You really got the invention of the riff. I mean, if you think of things the Beatles did, you know, Paperback Writer and stuff like that. But
it's not a riff. Hey, Dad, no, Kinks is a riff. The Beatles.
Kinks is a riff.
You're quite right. The Beatles don't do riffs, do they?
No, I'm thinking the Beatles are winning. I'm thinking Day Tripper.
Oh, Day Tripper, yeah.
Day Tripper. Beatles did do riffs, yeah, but not till, and then went on to do, you know, Birthday and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, before that, no, not really riffs. But the Kinks did invent that idea of what I think heavy metal musicians would call a linear riff.
Yeah.
And I think that was transformational.
Yeah. So this is a good series. We've got three. So the Rolling Stones invented the band way of dressing.
Yep.
Louis Armstrong invented the solo. The Kinks invented the riff. can there be any more? Well, I think we're going to have to leave that to the massive to decide whether there are any more. And if there are any more, get in touch with us. At, how do we get in touch, Alex? Can you chime in, Alex? Can you shout, Alex?
I certainly can.
Hello. Hey, hey, look, listen, viewers. Alex has materialised. Go on, what's the email address, Alex?
Hi, everybody. The email address is wiye.london@gmail.com.
Say that again, Alex.
wiye.london@gmail.com.
Get in.
Heard it here first, kids.
So we've had to reveal that all this time we've been recording, there's been a ghostly presence in the background, muted.
He's presiding over everything.
Yeah. I'd love you to welcome him.
And after this, Alex will be playing us a series of records and filming as well. But we pretend that we've never heard them. And listen to the... Phil Collins, you see. So you sent me this thing this morning about hypnosis. The music publishers of the same name.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's a guy called Merck Mercuriadis, who I think you probably remember back in the music industry. He started Sanctuary, and then he started this thing called Hypnosis. And they're just buying huge numbers of song catalogues. And I got the impression that they have big chunks of Morrissey and Elton John and Blondie and Chic and Ed Sheeran, Drake, Kanye West. I think got 37 big catalogues. I'm sure more, actually. And obviously doing really well. The year before last, they made $8.5 million. Last year, they made $81 million.
Is that turnover or profit?
I think that's profit, yeah.
That's my profit. God. All right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And they're spending inordinate amounts. It struck me that part of the reason for that, I think, is that musicians in the current climate are slightly panicked by the idea of they don't know what their catalogue will actually deliver for them in the future. There was a time when you could think, well, that will be fine, and I'll be touring that forever, and I'll be promoting that material, and I'll be making money out of it for a long time to come. But I'm not so sure that security is there anymore. And so people are deciding to sell their entire catalogue, something everyone sought to avoid so strenuously before, didn't they?
Well, except that there have been exceptions. I mean, because I think Courtney Love sold 25% of Nirvana quite a few years ago. Because, you know, somebody will come along and give you, you know, $10 million or whatever it is, which is nice to have. Of course, then, if you live long enough, you live to see it being worth about $100 million. And you should have held out. But, you know, who's to know?
You wrote a great piece in Word, I remember, about Kimberly Roo's catalogue. What? Kimberly Roo wrote Going Down to Liverpool
and Walking on Sunshine. Yeah.
And, you know, the big Eurovision winner too. Love Shine a Light, doesn't it? I mean, on the basis of those three songs, really, I mean, he sold his catalogue for something like £20 million.
Well, I don't think it was quite that much. But, you know, they managed it for a very, very long time between them and, continued to get good money out of Walking on Sunshine because they control the recording and control the song. And what this is about, all this, is your catalogue is there, and unless somebody really works it and somebody really promotes it, tries to make sure you get picked up for sync rights on the new so-and-so movie or, you know, used in a commercial, unless somebody really works it, you've no control over whether it's going to be worth a decent amount of money and an awful lot of money. And so the idea why people sell 25% or 50% is they go and find a partner who says, no, I can get more out of this catalog.
So those guys are going out there aggressively saying to kind of, you know, the people who are making movies.
They're just working it. They're just working it. And, you know, they're trying to make sure they're part of the thinking process, you know, so the holy grail in this area, from my understanding, is if you can get great catalogues from the 70s or the 80s that have been underexploited, that people haven't really thought about, that haven't turned up on loads of movie soundtracks, and you can work that stuff, you can pay quite a lot of money to the rights holder for a percentage of it, and you'll see a profit out of it. But it's a gamble like anything, because look what's happening in cinema at the moment. They can't even get movies put out in cinemas. So you're no guarantee what those kind of revenues are going to be in the future. But also, if you're 70-year-old rock star, you're sitting there thinking, what's most important to me? I pass this on to my children. Feckless ne'er-do-wells, whatever.
Yeah, who might run it into the ground anyway.
Well, they might
not earn any money from it, or it might not be worth much money.
Or they might earn a lot of money from it. Or, right now, I can have $20 million.
Yeah, and I can...
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I know that I've won. Exactly.
And I think that's kind of one of the things that happens. I think there's loads of really interesting, negotiations of that kind going on absolutely all the time, because pop music, I mean, you find loads of cases of this, don't you? If you look back to the 60s and people let their rights go because they thought, well, it can't be worth that much money. If somebody's going to give me $5,000 right now, that's a damn good deal. Never thinking that 50, 60 years down the track, that could be earning fortunes still. But there's no guarantee.
Which is why the people who were particularly canny, Dave Clark and the Dave Clark Five being a really good example, I think, were so impressive. I think Dave Clark just looked at all that and thought, This could last. And he bought up the rights to all sorts of things, didn't he?
He bought Ready Steady Go. Dave Clark owns the 60s.
Yeah.
But he only could buy it because he was so canny with his money during the time of the Dave Clark Five. He made his own records. The records came out in EMI.
That's right. He made the records, then took them to EMI and said, do you want to put this out? Yeah.
He was the first indie rock star, strangely enough.
Made two-thirds more profit
He probably kept more than anybody else, It's difficult to say whether he made more than the Beatles or Jerry and the Pacemakers or whatever. But I guarantee you he will have kept more and probably looked after it more. And so he was able to invest in, West End state shows, things like that. Remember that musical Time that ran
ages? Yeah.
He's very successful at that kind of thing. And bought all the, but bought pretty much all the footage of Ready, Steady, Go. So, he was a cannier operator than a lot of the people in the 60s. But it's, that whole thing, business about commercials really interests me, because I wrote the thing about this, as you say, in Word, that when you hear Donovan on commercials, which you do not infrequently, or you certainly did a few years ago, because a lot of Donovan songs, there's Mellow Yellow, there's Sunshine City, and there's There Is a Mountain. They were huge hits. They've got a lovely sound to them. Well, they're all pretty much all. He's re-recorded them. He's re-recorded them probably in his 50s or 60s. Because then, if people come to him for the song, he says, yes, you can have the song, but only if you use my recording.
Which is what Squeeze did, didn't it? Quite a lot of people done.
Then he's not giving half the money to buy records.
Yeah.
Or more than half the money to buy records. I don't know what.
But those versions that he re-recorded had to be absolutely note perfect.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they had to sound exactly like it.
Yeah, and within the commercial.
They wouldn't have wanted it.
No, yeah. Absolutely. They don't want something that sounds markedly different. Nobody saw any of that coming.
The Word Podcast. What's wrong with being sexy?
Oh, we have another classic podcast available from the vaults, the vaults. What is the vaults cover? Everyone always used to say the vaults, didn't they? When records were released, people always found old tapes that had been in the vaults somewhere, collecting dust.
Yeah.
And were suddenly, as if they hadn't been just poised, ready for a hugely commercial.
No, and now it's even worse. They're consumed by fire, aren't they, in the Universal Music.
That's right.
Anyway, go on, carry on.
But we've got another classic pod reavailable, and it was recorded, in fact, in my kitchen after the Word Christmas party. And it features
Dave. What year are we talking about now, do you think?
It would have been about 2008, would you think?
Oh, right. Okay.
I would imagine.
Okay,
so.
Go on.
And it's about bands that we used to be enthusiastic about, but we're not enthusiastic about anymore. So that well worth hearing. Bands, ugly groups.
Well, because that's a subject that's returned recently when we were talking to Simon Mayo, weren't we, about who were the ugliest groups.
And weirdly, we mentioned the very same culprits, Crabby Appleton, who was described in this as having hair like exploded mattresses. There they are.
There they are. I've got a picture of it.
Girls.
For the benefit of any Patreon supporters who are actually seeing this as opposed to merely hearing this, you can see the full splendor of Crabby Appleton. One at a time, ladies. Take a ticket.
Take a ticket. There's a News Mania item about how prog rock is back. There's a thing about Tower Records closing and the various nostalgic stages of the development of the record shop. And gigs of the year, amazingly, Lily Allen, and not amazing in Lucinda Williams' case, but Lily Allen, I remember going to see Lily Allen, her first gig, I think it was absolutely amazing. And there's a thing about the philosophical thing about the future of gigs and how they might eventually acquire some of the characteristics of classical music. And I think Dave, were probably right.
I think that's right, you see, because the whole business of billing what you're about to hear before you hear it. So that you've got access to if you're one of our Patreon supporters. And please do consider the benefits of being a Patreon supporter. You can take part in our Friday night quiz, which is hotting up. It takes place at 6 o'clock every Friday evening. You also get the opportunity to be in the room, so to speak, as we start recording more Word in Your Ear conversations with authors. We did one a few weeks ago with Graham Thompson about his John Martin book. Coming up, we're doing Joe Banks talking about his Holguin book. We got Kenneth Womack joining us from the United States. Kenneth Womack, who previously was on Word in Your Ear, talking about George Martin. We'll be talking about his book about the last year of John Lennon. And looking further forward, we've got Justin Quirk talking about glam metal. So all these benefits and more can be yours if you go and look at patreon.com/wordinyourear and find out more about them. So we're just going to leave you with...
Mention the new patrons.
Oh, God, yes,
new patrons,
of course.
Yeah, the various people that have signed up, bless them. We're enormously grateful. So many thanks to Thomas Hewitt, to Ayala O'Halloran, to Mike Gola, and to Nick Maroney. Brilliant.
Very nice to have them on board. And, why not add your name to that roll of honour in weeks to come? We're very grateful to Owen Parker, our friend Owen Parker, friend of the pod and musician, who heard us ranting in a recent pod about the attempts to barrelerise, rewrite the lyrics of Robbie Robertson, The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. And, he took some of our fulminations and set them to music. We'll leave you with this. What do you begin with this?
Unlike my father, who I will never understand. Unlike the others below me, you took the rebel stand. Framed and powered to enslave, but it's time we laid hate in its grave.
If you don't want to sing The Night That Drove Old Dixie Down, I've got a really novel idea for you. Don't sing it. Trample on my relationship with The Night That Drove Old Dixie Down by putting any stupid ideas.